This is the Poetry Foundation's Essential American Poets podcast. Essential American Poets is an online audio poetry collection. The poets in the collection were selected in 2006 by Donald Hall when he was poet laureate. Recordings of the poets he selected are available online at poetryfoundation.org and poetryarchive.org. In this edition of the podcast, we'll hear poems by Philip Levine. Philip Levine, the son of Russian Jewish immigrants, was born in industrial Detroit in 1928. Growing up, he heard adults discussing the political ideologies of the 1930s and the utopian promise of the Spanish Civil War. Early on, Levine acquired his own left-wing political awareness. While working in the auto plants of Detroit in the 1950s, Levine resolved that his poetry would find a voice for the voiceless, those blue-collar workers whose lives weren't represented in American letters. Levine stayed true to this mission. His heroes are often struggling in or defeated by an industrial society. His poems take on poverty, dispossession, and the assembly line, a focus that leads some critics to describe his work as brooding and without solace. Others find a sense of victory and defeat in the poetry, despite its painful quality. Edward Hirsch describes Levine as a quintessentially urban American poet. Levine is the author of more than a dozen books of poetry, most recently News of the World. Many of his poetry collections have garnered prominent awards, including The Simple Truth, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1994, and What Work Is, winner of the National Book Award. For 2 years, he served as chair of the literature panel of the National Endowment for the Arts, and he was elected a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets in 2000. He lives in Brooklyn and in Fresno, California, and teaches at New York University. The following 6 poems were recorded in New York City in 2007.
Ford Highland Park was once the second largest Ford assembly plant. Now it's, I don't know what it is. It's empty. It's probably a warehouse of some kind. Highland Park is actually a city within the city limits of Detroit. There are 2 cities, Highland Park and Hamtramck. They are not part of Dante's vision of hell, by the way. They're just little cities. What work is? We stand in the rain in a long line waiting at Ford Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting. Shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead, a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today," for any reason he wants. You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him? Held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide, and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek. You've never done something so simple, so obvious, not because you're too young or too dumb, not because you're jealous or even mean, or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No, just because you don't know what work is. This poem grew out of my return to Detroit, the city where I grew up, after the riots of 1967, called race riots in the press, called the Great Rebellion in the city itself. It was during the Vietnam War we were fighting two racial wars, one in American cities and one in Southeast Asia. And as I went back to the city, I discovered in the language of that day that I was part of the problem, not part of the solution. I was now middle-aged, I was middle class, and I was white. And I was, to some degree, just overwhelmed. They feed, they lion. Out of burlap sacks, out of bearing butter, out of black bean and wet slate bread, out of the acids of rage, the candor of tar, out of creosote, gasoline, drive shafts, wooden dollies, they lie and grow. Out of the gray hills of industrial barns, out of rain, out of bus ride West Virginia to kiss my ass, out of buried aunties, mothers hardening like pounded stumps, out of stumps, out of the bones need to sharpen and the muscles to stretch, they lie and grow. Earth is eating trees, fence posts, gutted cars. Earth is calling in her little ones, come home, from pig balls, from the ferocity of pig driven to holiness, from the furred ear and the full jowl, come the repose of the hung belly, from the purpose they lie and grow. From the sweet glues of the trotters come the sweet kinks of the fist, from the full flower of the hams, the thorax of caves, from bow down come rise up, come they lie in from the reeds of shovels, the grained arm that pulls the hands, they lie and grow. From my five arms and all my hands, from all my white sins forgiven, they feed. From my car passing under the stars, they lion. From my children inherit, from the oak turned to a wall, they lion. From they sack and they belly opened, and all that was hidden burning on the oil-stained earth, they feed, they lion, and he comes. During the war, when my brother came home from war, he carried his left arm in a black sling, but assured us most of it was still there. Spring was late. The trees forgot to leaf out. I stood in a long line waiting for bread. The woman behind me said it was shameless. Someone as strong as I, still home, still intact, while her Michael was burning to death. Yes, she could feel the fire, could smell his pain all the way from Tarawa, or was it Midway? And he so young, younger than I, who was only 14, taller, more handsome in his white uniform, turning slowly gray, the way unprimed wood grays slowly in the grate when the flames sputter and die. I think I'm going mad, she said, when I turned to face her. She placed both hands on my shoulders, kissed each eyelid, hugged me to her breast, and whispered wetly in my bad ear words I'd never heard before. When I got home, my brother ate the bread carefully, one slice at a time, until nothing was left but a blank plate. Did you see her? He asked. The woman in hell, Michael's wife. That afternoon I walked the crowded streets, looking for something I couldn't name, something familiar, a face or a voice or less, but not these shards of ash that fell from heaven. In 1965, I lived in Spain, very close to what was there called the abattoir, the slaughterhouse. And I used to see animals driven to the slaughterhouse, not driven in trucks, but driven on the ground. They walked. And they seemed somehow to anticipate something good wasn't waiting for them. The title itself comes from a line by Isaac Dinesen in an interview she gave about the changes in the world she'd noticed. Animals are passing from our lives. It's wonderful how I jog on four honed-down ivory toes, my massive buttocks slipping like oiled parts with each light step. I'm to market. I can smell the sour grooved block. I can smell the blade that opens the hole and the pudgy white fingers that shake out the intestines like a hanky. In my dreams, the snouts drool on the marble. Suffering children, suffering flies, suffering the consumers who won't meet their steady eyes for fear they could see. The boy who drives me along believes that any moment I'll fall on my side and drum my toes like a typewriter or squeal and shit like a new housewife discovering television, or that I'll turn like a beast cleverly to hook his teeth with my teeth. No, not this pig. These two great poets met in Brooklyn in 1929. They didn't know that both would soon die. 3 years later, Crane would leap off the stern of a ship. And in 1936, Garcia Lorca would be assassinated by the Falange, the fascist party of Spain. On the meeting of Garcia Lorca and Hart Crane. Brooklyn, 1929. Of course, Crane's been drinking and has no idea who this curious Andalusian is, unable even to speak the language of poetry. The young man who brought them together knows both Spanish and English, but he has a headache from jumping back and forth from one language to another. For a moment's relief, he goes to the window to look down on the East River, darkening below as the early night comes on. Something flashes across his sight, a double vision of such horror, he has to slap both his hands across his mouth to keep from screaming. Let's not be frivolous. Let's not pretend the two poets gave each other wisdom or love or even a good time. Let's not invent a dialogue of such eloquence that even the ants in your own house won't forget it. The two greatest poetic geniuses alive meet. And what happens? A vision comes to an ordinary man staring at a filthy river. Have you ever had a vision? Have you ever shaken your head to pieces and jerked back at the image of your young son falling through open space? Not from the stern of a ship bound from Veracruz to New York, but from the roof of the building he works on? Have you risen from bed to pace until dawn, to beg a merciless God to take these pictures away? Oh, yes. Let's bless the imagination. It gives us the myths we live by. Let's bless the visionary power of the human, the only animal that's got it. Bless the exact image of your father dead and mine dead. Bless the images that stalk the corners of our sight and will not let go. The young man was my cousin, Arthur Lieberman, then a language student at Columbia, who told me all this before he died quietly in his sleep in 1983 in a hotel in Perugia. A good man, Arthur. He survived graduate school, Later came home to Detroit and sold pianos right through the Depression. He loaned my brother a used one to compose his hideous songs on, which Arthur thought were genius. What an imagination Arthur had. This poem grew out of my mother's death. She lived to be 94, and neither of my brothers wanted really anything to do with her ashes, which I wanted very much, and so I took them and buried them in my yard and planted some of her favorite flowers in the soil that they took part in. Burial rites. Even on a rare morning of rain, like this morning, with the low sky hoarding its riches except for a few mock tears, the hard ground accepts nothing. 6 years ago, I buried my mother's ashes beside a young lilac that's now taller than I and stuck the stub of a rose bush into her dirt, where, like everything else not human, it thrives. The small blossoms never unfurl. Whatever they know, they keep to themselves until a morning rain or a night wind pares the petals down to nothing. Even the neighbor cat who shits daily on the paths and then hides deep in the jungle of the weeds refuses to purr. It's right to end up beside the woman who bore me, to shovel into the dirt whatever's left and leave only a name for someone who wants it. Think of it, my name, no longer a portion of me, no longer inflated or bruised, no longer stewing in a rich compost of memory or the simpler one of bone, kitty litter, the roots of the eucalyptus I planted back in 73. A tiny me, taking nothing, giving nothing, empty and free at last.
That was Philip Levine, recorded in New York City in 2007 and used by permission of Wesleyan University Press, Alfred A. Knopf, and the author. You've been listening to the Essential American Poets podcast, produced by the Poetry Foundation in collaboration with poetryarchive.org. To learn more about Philip Levine and other essential American poets, and to hear more poetry, go to poetryfoundation.org.